in the cloudless sunshine. Meg looked very like a rose herself. Neither silk, lace, nor orange flowers would she have. "I don't want to look strange or fixed up today," she said. "I don't want a fashionable wedding, but only those about me whom I love, and to them I wish to look and be my familiar self." So she made her wedding gown herself. Her sisters braided up her pretty hair, and the only ornaments she wore were the lilies of the valley, which her John liked best of all the flowers that grew.
"You do look just like our own dear Meg, only so very sweet and lovely that I should hug you if it wouldn't crumple your dress," cried Amy.
"Then I am satisfied. But don't mind my dress. I want a great many crumples of this sort put into it today." And Meg opened her arms to her sisters. "Now I'm going to tie John's cravat for him, and then to stay a few minutes with Father quietly in the study." And Meg ran down to perform these little ceremonies. As the younger girls stand together, it may be a good time to tell of a few changes which 3 years have wrought in their appearance, for all are looking their best just now. Jo's angles are much softened. The curly crop has lengthened into a thick coil. There is a fresh color in her brown cheeks, a soft shine in her eyes, and only gentle words fall from her sharp tongue today. Beth has grown slender, pale, and more quiet than ever. The beautiful, kind eyes are larger, and in them lies an expression that saddens one, although it is not sad itself. It is the shadow of pain which touches the young face with such pathetic patience. But Beth seldom complains, and always speaks hopefully of being better soon. Amy is with truth considered the flower of the family, not beautiful, but possessed of that indescribable charm called grace, with wonderfully fair complexion, keen blue eyes, and curls more golden and abundant than ever. All three wore suits of thin silver gray, their best gowns for the summer, and looked just what they were, fresh-faced, happy-hearted girls. There were to be no ceremonious performances. Everything was to be as natural and homelike as possible. So when Aunt March arrived, she was scandalized to see the bride come running to welcome and lead her in, to find the bridegroom fastening up a garland that had fallen down, and to catch a glimpse of the paternal minister marching upstairs with a wine bottle under each arm.
"Upon my word, here's a state of things," cried the old lady, taking the seat of honor prepared for her. "You oughtn't to be seen till the last minute, child."
"I'm not a show, Auntie, and no one is coming to stare at me, to criticize my dress, or count the cost. I'm too happy to care what anyone says or thinks, and I'm going to have my little wedding just as I like it. John, dear, here's your hammer." And away went Meg to help.
Mr. Brooke didn't even say thank you, but as he stooped for the unromantic tool, he kissed his little bride behind the folding door with a look that made Aunt March whisk out her handkerchief with a sudden dew in her sharp old eyes. A crash, a cry, and a laugh from Laurie, accompanied by "Jupiter Ammon, Joe's upset the cake again," caused a momentary flurry, which was hardly over when a flock of cousins arrived.
"Don't let that young giant come near me. He worries me worse than mosquitoes," whispered the old lady to Amy, as the rooms filled and Laurie's black head towered above the rest.
"He has promised to be very good today, and he can be perfectly elegant if he likes," returned Amy.
There was no bridal procession, but a sudden silence fell upon the room as Mr. March and the young pair took their places under the green arch. Mother and sisters gathered close, as if loath to give Meg up. The fatherly voice broke more than once, which only seemed to make the service more beautiful and solemn. The bridegroom's hand trembled visibly, and no one heard his replies. But Meg looked straight up in her husband's eyes and said, "I will," with such tender trust in her own face and voice that her mother's heart rejoiced.